Presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
Well, it's nice to be home. Here I am back in Portland, Oregon, and back from a week in New York City. We'll be off to Los Angeles on Friday of this week for the opening of Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour. I'll be in New York on Monday of next week for same, Monday and Tuesday. And it's going to be a wild time. And a lot of discussion about this, about global warming as one dimension of a collection of crises that the world is facing as a consequence of six and a half billion people and the impact that we're having on this planet. And there's a lot of us who are very concerned about it, and some folks who say, hey, that concern is very misplaced. Mark Morano's with us. He's the Mark, is your title still Communications Director for the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee?
Well, there was a change in November. I'm now, actually in January, but I'm now the Communications Director for the minority, GOP minority, not the
so,
overall.
Yeah, okay. That's what I thought. I thought that. Okay, and on
now.
The staff. But, yeah, right. Hustle. Yeah, there you go. And on the staff of the Senator, the great Senator from Oklahoma, Mr. Inhofe, the epw.senate.gov, the website for the Environmental Public Works Committee. Mark, Barbara Boxer and Bernie Sanders. Bernie's been on this program about this. I think we may have Barbara, Senator Boxer, scheduled, talking about their trip to Greenland and their concerns about how Greenland is melting. Although apparently not as fast as every place else. We've got tundra all over the Siberia and northern Alaska. You've got Russia planting a flag in the North Pole. Just, you know, 10 years ago, it was no water. It was ice. Yeah. So anyhow, you guys are out there saying that this is nothing to worry about.
No, actually, I was on the Greenland trip with Senator Sanders and Senator Boxer. I had a great time, actually. I was actually able to confront, to use that word gently, I mean, I was polite as I could be, the UN, the handpicked UN scientist that went on a trip, a man named Dr. Richard Alley. And I was able to make a presentation, several of them actually, during question and answer and other things, pointing out that what we witnessed in Greenland in the summer of 2007, we went in July, was nothing more than normal summer melt. Greenland began melting in the 1880s. The rate of melt was significantly faster during the 1920s and 40s before man-made CO2 went in the atmosphere. 80% came after 1940. I was able to show through peer-reviewed studies that Greenland has been cooling since the 1950s. A 2005 study showed Greenland gaining ice in the center, losing some on the middle, basically for a net sea contribution to sea level rise of about neutral. There is absolutely nothing alarming in Greenland except unproven computer models of the future. It is that simple. I did a 2,500-word report upon my return. It's posted at epw.senate.gov. Barbara Boxer and Senator Sanders quoted a Greenland official who stood up and said, this place was colder when I was a kid. Well, yeah, that may have been true. It was colder in Greenland back maybe in the 70s, but if he had said, this place was warmer when my father and grandfather were kids, that would have been more accurate. There was no perspective on this trip, and frankly, the hand-picked UN scientist who showed us Florida underwater and the coastline flooded if Greenland melted, that was just not scientifically even, it was actually reprehensible that he would show that without all that context, which I just gave you. And I actually quote Robert Gigenbach, University of Pennsylvania, Ivy League University geologist, who explains that Greenland is melting so slow, if there is any contribution to sea level, that at the current rate it would be at least 3,500 years before you got to any level that Al Gore shows you or the UN tries to scare you.
I didn't know that geologists were climate scientists. Isn't that sort of like quoting a veterinarian about...
Let's not go there. Everyone knows climate experts range from geologists to astrophysicists to meteorologists to climatologists.
Well, for example, in your report that is published over at epw.senate.gov,
sure.
It's called Latest Scientific Studies Refute Fears of Greenland Melt. You quote, for example, Peter Chilek of the Space and Remote Sensing Sciences Laboratory.
I quote
Los Angeles
his peer-reviewed
National
study,
Laboratory.
Yes. Yes.
Right. And, you know, one of the few that's been studied, well, actually, with regard to specific parts of the world, I mean, there's a whole variety of these, but these published in geophysical research letters. However, you didn't quote his study that was published in volume 32, number 14705 in 2005 in Geophysical Research Letters, in which he said the exact opposite. He says, and I quote from his abstract, first of all, toss out his quote that you have.
He said we find current Greenland warming not unprecedented, and temperatures of similar magnitude or higher, 1920 to 30 was 50% higher than the current 1995 to 2005 warming.
Right.
Okay. I'm sorry, well, I don't know what your quote is, but
well, this
you're
this
saying
is
he did two contradictory studies in the same year?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Here's the abstract. He says general circulation models, GCM, and it's talking about, you know, the circulation of water around the coast of Greenland and how that's going to affect the temperature of Greenland.
Yes.
Predict that the temperature changes in Greenland should proceed at a faster rate than the global temperature change. Until now, there's been no confirmation that Greenland's long-term temperature changes are related to the global warming.
Right.
And that they proceed faster than the global temperature change. And then they use double correlations between the Greenland temperature records, North Atlantic Oscillation Index, and global temperature change. We find a region in Greenland that is not affected by the NAO, not the North Atlantic Oscillation, one region. Using this region as an indicator, we find that the ratio of the Greenland to global temperature change due to global warming is 2.2, in broad agreement with global circulation model predictions.
I don't know the exact quote you're throwing at me that he said. However,
it was published 18 May 2005, accepted 23 June 2005.
Right. But using one, but even that's part of the sort of the game.
No, but my point is, I went through this thing. I spent, you know, Louise and I spent a couple hours this morning going through the science that you're quoting on this. And what I found over and over again was that you were quoting people who either were in the pocket of industry or people who had published articles that in many cases contradicted themselves. And finally, that talking about one part of Greenland, I mean, in fact, actually, one of the studies that you quote points out that in some parts of Greenland, the ice is getting thinner, in other parts, it's getting thicker. And so if you want to pick a spot and say, okay, we're going to extrapolate everything from this spot, you can come up with any result you want.
No, but you look at the current level of sea level. In fact, the Ivy League geologist Giegenbach said it best. If sea levels are rising in response to global warming, no one's told sea levels. It's not even really measurable, detectable. The only fear is unproven computer models. You know that. Do you realize the UK Met Office, one of the leading global warming, man-made global warming proponents, came out August 9th and admitted global warming stopped in 1998, that global temperatures have not increased since then, and you know how they tried to calm their global warming proponents, the people that want to believe this so that we can come up with solutions? They said that it'll begin in earnest after 2009. This is after Al Gore...
After the elections, right? Why is it then, Mark Morano?
I'm saying the UK Met Office is on record. The New York Times has actually reported this. No current weather is outside of natural variability. The global warming temperatures, both surface and satellite, have stopped warming since 98. And the only explanation people can have is deposit more unproven computer models, which Dr. Jim Renwick, a lead UN scientist in June came out.
Well, here's a scientific. Let me just toss a scientific question at you then.
He just said that the UN models don't account for half the climate variability. And
no, I understand all that. And
the whole debate is about computer models. That's it.
Here's the question. If Venus and Mars are warming up, in other words, we're getting more solar radiation right now, which is one of your major arguments about why there might be some.
In 1,000 years, yes.
Right. And yet, at the same time, you say we're not warming up.
I'm saying that we've definitely warmed in the 20th century 1 degree Fahrenheit. But
so we are warming up. So there is global warming,
over
you say it's caused
years.
By solar.
Yeah, actually, over 100 years we have, yes. Actually, particularly since the 1970s. But my point is, if you look at it like the way...
This is
an important point.
Okay.
James Hansen and Al Gore like to say, ha-ha, this is the hottest year. You know, the 1998 being the hottest in the U.S., that was just revised by NASA. Now 1934 was. Again, back during FDR's time, we now have the hottest year in the U.S. My point being is that, yes, global warming has stopped since 1998, but
aware of the argument, Mark? Yeah, I understand. Are you aware of the argument that one of the reasons why it seems to be slowing down is because there is such a massive increase in particulate matter in the atmosphere that's reflecting sunlight out as a consequence of the explosion of industrialization in China, particularly all the burning of coal?
That's a theory about why the 1970s, why it cooled until the 1970s. But actually, the UK Met Office is blaming, you know, ocean circulation patterns and other natural factors in the fact that global warming has stopped since 1998. There's a panic going on.
So how do we have more greenhouse gases and more solar radiation and we're not warming up?
That's a very good question. There's so many factors in the atmosphere. You have ocean circulation. You have the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. You have El Niños, La Niñas. You have the Southern Hemisphere basically not warming much since the 1970s.
And none of it has anything to do with ExxonMobil.
What? Look, the money's $50 billion to some, you know, $19 million and some change on the other side. For you to mention a funded scientist by oil when you have James Hansen, Michael Mann, and Michael Oppenheimer from Environmental Defense, all these scientists you see on TV that are funded by the mega environmental industry, environmental, left-wing environmental industry, this is, you're misleading your listeners here, Tom.
Okay. Well, people can check it out for themselves.
Mark EPW.Senate.gov.
Exactly. EPW.Senate.gov. Thanks a lot, Mark. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
When it's not always raining, there'll be days like this. When there's no one complaining, there'll be days like this. Everything falls into place like the flick of a switch. Well, my mama told me there'll be days like this.
I wonder if Carl Rove is singing that song right now.
When you don't need to worry.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you.
Days like this.
Well, I don't know. For me, all I have to remember is last week in Manhattan, on Tuesday, I'm almost thrown out of bed by a lightning strike so loud I thought a bomb had gone off in Midtown. It's around 6:15 in the morning. And within 2 hours, there's a tornado in one of the five boroughs. Never, ever happened before. And the subways are flooded. The weather has gone nuts. The next day it's so hot, I've got a business meeting I didn't even bother wearing a sports coat for or a jacket for. And the day after that, it's so cold, I'm wishing I had my jacket with me because I'm freezing in Manhattan. And then it's like, you know, the weather's gone nuts. I'm sorry. The weather has gone nuts. And now we have Denmark and Russia competing over at Canada, the Prime Minister of Canada, you know, the Russians set a flag, the Canadians sent their Prime Minister to claim the North Pole. And the only problem the U.S. has is that Ronald Reagan was so enthusiastic about catering to his bizarre right-wing base who is afraid of the United Nations. Anything cooperative, they're afraid of. Well, you can't cooperate with people. After all, people are evil. They'll take advantage. We've got to have absolute sovereignty. Although we will let multinational corporations run the United States with NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO. No problem there. But we can't have an international body telling us, for example, where our boundaries are or who we can declare war on. So in any case, because Reagan refused to sign this International Treaty of the Seas, this UN document, we don't have the legal authority to claim what might be where 25% of the world's undiscovered oil and gas is up in the Arctic, and not to mention the shipping lanes. And the rush is on, and Bush doesn't know what he's going to do about it. And in the meantime, Karl Rove's heading out of town. And then on top of that, you've got this terrible confluence of disasters from global warming. And yes, it's real. There's an absolute consensus that global warming is real. You know, Mark's comments aside, there's an absolute consensus among the vast majority of the world's scientists, and I'm like well over 99.9%. And it's not just global warming. It's the net productive capacity of the planet is being inhaled by we Americans. So anyhow, what's up with Carl? And I'm curious about what's up with Karl Rove and what your thoughts are on this. My take on this is that Karl Rove is getting out while the getting's good, that he is, by doing this, he's going to make it far more difficult for Congress to come after him. Now people say, well, wait a minute, they can still issue subpoenas. Look at Harriet Myers. Yes, they can. And as we all know, it's all about public opinion. And public opinion in the United States is driven by our infotainment media. By our infotainment so-called news business. And the infotainment so-called news business has cameras and reporters all over Washington, D.C., New York, Los Angeles, you know, a few big cities. But not in Texas. Or not in the Bermuda, or wherever Karl Rove decides he's going to alight. The story right now is he's going to return to Texas as of August 31st. So, for example, you know, Harriet Myers, that's a good example. If Harriet Myers was still the lawyer for the White House and was still walking in and out of the White House every day, the fact that she had been subpoenaed by the Senate and that she's fighting the subpoena and the subpoena's ongoing, it would be in the news every day because they could get a reporter down there with a camera and easily get a picture. It's all driven by,
hey, Ralph, do we have footage on this?
Yeah, we got some footage right here.
See, that's the bottom line. If you can get good video, well, Karl Rove gets out of town, no video. And so any story about investigations of him by the Democrats, or at least attempts to investigate him, and his refusing to show up, is going to end up being a one-hour, one-day story. And my guess is that Rove is going to do a Henry Kissinger, that he's going to create a think tank. He's going to retire down to Texas. He's going to have his little friend, little think tank. He'll have a bunch of people working with him so that people can hire him at arm's length. And it's not like they're really hiring Karl Rove. It'll probably have a name that doesn't even have his name in it. Like Strategic Studies Academy Incorporated, LLC, Bermuda. He will, of course, like Halliburton, you know, incorporated offshore so he doesn't have to pay U.S. taxes. And now's his chance, his last 18 months here, or 16 months, well, let's see the exact time, 525 days, 12 hours, 27 minutes, 53 seconds, to make a fortune. You know, his $180,000, $200,000, whatever he's making a year salary as a high monkey muck in the Bush administration, going to go away, although he probably has a pension and health care benefits and whatnot. But here's now his opportunity, to make it, to strike it rich. There will be a book deal, you can guarantee that, and it'll be a book that the right-wing think tanks and the right-wing hyper-wealthy will go out and buy, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50,000 copies as soon as the thing is laid down so that it hits the New York Times bestseller list. The New York Times finally got wise to this a couple of years ago. They started putting these little daggers next to the name. Ann Coulter's book, oh, somebody bought 50,000 of them. That's why it's on. In any case, that's in my opinion, what he's going to do. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Well, let's see. If Iran was importing weapons into Iraq, and it could be demonstrated, if they busted an Iranian importation process of weapons into Iraq, say 100,000 Russian-made automatic weapons, for example, you know, some $40 million worth of stuff, if that had happened, I think that we would be bombing Iran, the very next day. Or Iran, pardon my mispronunciation. So the question, are we going to begin bombing Italy? A chance discovery at Rome's busy Fiumicino airport led anti-mafia investigators to a huge black market transaction in which Iraqi and Italian partners haggled over shipping more than 100,000 Russian-made automatic weapons into Iraq. Iraqi government officials were involved in the deal, apparently without the knowledge of the U.S. Baghdad command. Which raises two questions. One, you know, should we begin bombing Italy, I guess. And two, if we didn't know what they were doing, Does that mean that we should because they're a puppet government, or does that mean that we shouldn't because it's a real sovereign nation? Because the Bushies kind of want to have it both ways. Another fascinating story in today's news, this over at Roll Call, the kind of insider newspaper for folks inside the Beltway. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has quietly shelved plans to hold the Senate in pro forma session this month after the White House agreed to refrain from making any executive appointments during the senator's August break. This is interesting. You'll recall we had a conversation about this a week or two ago, you know, in which Harry Reid had said that he was concerned. I mean, there's some nominees, for example, the Veterans Administration. Jim Nicholson, the head of the VA, whose only qualification for the job is that he's a Republican hack who raised a lot of money for the Bush campaign. Former ambassador to the Vatican, another, you know, political plum for raising money for the campaign. Big time, you know, lawyer, businessman, fundraiser from Colorado, as I recall. Jim Nicholson has decided that he's going to leave the VA and go home. And the Democrats are salivating at the prospect of his successor being in front of them for confirmation hearings because it'll give them an opportunity to point out everything that's going wrong with the VA. And so there's this speculation. Larry Scott from VAWatchdog.org on this program a week or so ago speculating that Bush would make a recess appointment. There are a whole bunch of judges and U.S. attorneys positions that require confirmation that are open. And everybody was pretty much expecting that Bush was going to be making huge numbers of recess appointments during this recess. And, in fact, Harry Reid had said that one of the ways that he would prevent that was by calling the Senate into session one day a week so that they never actually went into recess. Well, he's not doing that. And we were speculating out loud, you know, a couple of weeks ago on this program, what does that mean? I mean, does that mean that Harry Reid knows something we don't know? That there's some kind of fix in, or does that mean that the Democrats rolled over and then you're going to have a whole bunch of recess appointments and it's going to be, you know, another, you know, Bush is going to win another one? Well, it looks pretty clearly, if the roll call is right, and they're rarely wrong, that Harry Reid has made a deal and said, cool, no problem. Or Bush has said, cool, no problem. We will not make recess appointments, no executive appointments during the senator's August break. And Harry Reid agreed to that. And the question in my mind is, what did Harry Reid get in exchange for that? Or more importantly, what did Bush? Let me flip that around. What did Harry Reid give in exchange for that? Harry Reid got no recess appointments. What did he give? I'll bet it's the FISA deal. Yes, we'll give you enough votes to get FISA through if you'll agree not to do recess appointments. That's my guess of what the quid pro quo was. Time will tell. Chris Dodd says he's drawing up legislation to strengthen subprime mortgage lending standards. At the same time, a committee of British unrelated, this is just quick headlines here, this is from thinkprogress.org. The Think Fast headlines. A committee of British members of parliament warning the escalation in Iraq is likely to fail. Number of truck bombs and other large al-Qaeda-style attacks have declined nearly 50%. The number of daily attacks, however, has reached new highs. Alan Greenspan has a job with a German bank. And, well, I guess that's about it. That's about it. So, a lot on the plate today, a lot on the table. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, if you want to participate in our blog over at airamerica.com, our message board over at tomhartman.com, it's all out there. Sheila in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Sheila, what's up? Listening on KPOT. Sheila? No Sheila. Okay, let's try Richard in North Bergen, New Jersey. Hey, Richard.
Hello.
Hey, Richard, you're on the air. What's up?
Okay, two things. Yeah, I'm afraid that Harry Reid gave away the farm again to get something which shouldn't be happening anyway.
Yeah, that's my guess, is that he gave away FISA, but I'm just guessing.
Also, too, you were asking what you think Karl Rove makes.
Mm-hmm.
I looked up I believe he's under the senior executive service,
mm-hmm.
and it's a minimum of $111,000. and a maximum of $168,000.
Okay, so we can assume then that he's making $168,000.
Probably.
And they probably figured out ways to get bonuses to him. But these guys, I mean, when they've been loyal servants to the billion-dollar Bush empire, they walk away multi-millionaires. And so, you know, he's got some time here to become a multi-millionaire. And I absolutely predict he will, and I'm quite sure I'm right. So, interesting. Richard, thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Richard in Seattle. Hey, Richard. Another
hey,
Richard.
Thanks for taking my call. You're getting to be a hard guy to reach.
Well, it's, yeah.
I just wanted to discuss
a blessing and a curse, I guess.
Yes, it is. You're becoming more and more popular. I just wanted to mention regarding your first guest call-in about the climate change.
Mark Morano, yeah.
You know, it's all well and good to debate the virtues of any given computer model for what may come in the future. But with paleoclimatology, we know darn well what happened in the past.
Yeah.
And seasonal variability aside, you know, we know where sea levels were. We also know currently chunks of Alaska are getting gouged away. There are islands in the Pacific that are getting inundated. But more to the point, I've been reading a lot of books lately, like The 2 Mile Time Machine and Under a Green Sky, and a lot of paleoclimatological books. Mm-hmm. And one thing that really just struck me very profoundly was this notion that we've not been modifying the global warming, if you will, for just a few hundred years. We've been doing it for literally thousands of years.
Ever since the agricultural revolution.
Exactly. Ever since we started growing food and crops, especially things like rice, which produce a lot of methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas, we've been warming the planet. Technically, by the regular periodic cycle of warming and cooling of the planet, we should be deep in the throes of a new ice age by now, and we're not.
Mm.
And the reason I suspect, and paleoclimatologists, people who study the past history of our climate, know, is that it's because of the greenhouse gases. If they weren't there, we would be in another ice age by now.
Yeah, there was another very interesting study that I saw. I don't recall if it was a full-blown study or if it was speculation in one of the... It was either in Science or New Scientist. I subscribe to three of these publications. I get Science because I'm an AAAS member, and I get New Scientist, and I get Science News. And one of them, they were suggesting that if we were to suddenly clean up all the particulate matter in the air, if we were to stop throwing soot up, particularly if China and India were to stop doing it, they being the largest sources now of particulate matter because their tailpipe exhaust is just like, you know, really god-awful horrific. If we were to do that, it would reduce the reflection of sunlight hitting the Earth and thus increase the amount of heat hitting the Earth to the point that we could have a really radical and really sudden increase in global warming. And so there's this terrible thing about, you know, okay, we've got asthma and people are dying and cancer and everything else as a consequence of all this particulate matter, these small, you know, carbon-based particles that are in most cases very highly toxic. They're you know, all these volatile compounds and whatnot. But we get rid of them and we make global warming so very, very much worse. It's absolutely bizarre. By the way, I was not suggesting in the last segment that we should be drilling in the Arctic, just pointing out the irony of the fact that the Bush administration, while they're so, you know, bloviating so hysterically about drilling in the Arctic, that now they can't because they never signed the treaty. Karen in Los Angeles. Hey, Karen, about a half a minute here before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Yeah, just a quick question of, you know, that if you might want to pose to these experts, what's the worst that would happen if we accepted that we caused global warming? What is so bad about not drilling for oil, not buying oil from the Arabs?
Because then the big oil companies would, the next step in that is, okay, if there are disasters happening and there is a cost associated with them, let's have ExxonMobil pay part of that cost. It's called the externalities.
Yeah.
What the oil companies, the oil industry, and everybody associated with it, really, the auto industry and everybody else have been doing for the better part of 100 years is they have been internalizing profits and externalizing costs. They've been dropping the external costs on us. We pick up the costs of the cancers. We pick up the costs of global warming. We pick up the costs of the environmental disasters. We pick up the cost of Katrina. And if they were to acknowledge that they played some role in that, then there would be a very strong case to be made to say, and you're going to pay for it. This is what Al Gore is suggesting with his carbon tax, and it makes perfect sense. But that, Karen, is why they're so afraid of that topic. And thank you very much for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio. We'll be right back.
minutes before the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. And things are getting just stranger and stranger out there in the world. Yeah, maybe we are. Maybe David Pratt is. David Pratt, an American living in Peterborough, England, wearing a T-shirt that said, "Don't piss me off, I'm running out of places to hide the bodies." And the Peterborough City Council has cited him. He says he bought the T-shirt in Venice Beach, California. He says most people who see it just chuckle. But he's really concerned, because if they really and truly bust him for it, it could screw up his plans to become a British citizen and have all that national health care and, you know, pensions and stuff like that. So it's a tough one. The stock market seems to be recovering, by the way. I find this very interesting. We'll talk about this at length a little later on in the week, I think. But in the great crash of 29, when the stock market fell off the edge of the earth, Herbert Hoover was encouraged to encourage the Fed, and the Fed was encouraged to increase liquidity. That is, to increase, you know, the money sloshing around, to make credit more easily available so that people could dig their way out of the hole that got dug. And he didn't do it. He just went along with his free market beliefs. And things got worse and worse and worse, 29, 30, 31, 32, until Franklin Roosevelt was elected in 32 and came into office in 33. Things got worse and worse and worse, and we had the Great Depression. So what happened on Friday, as the market started to tank, as a result of something very similar to all the stock speculation in 29, this time it was real estate speculation, but really, it's buying on margin is buying on margin, whether you're buying a house with 1% down or 0% down or 5% down, or whether you're buying stock with 10% down, it's still buying on margin. And what the Fed did is they injected over $30 billion into the market, not into the stock market, but into the cash market, basically, by buying not treasuries, which is what the Fed usually buys in order to increase liquidity, because really the Great Depression was a liquidity crisis. They didn't buy treasuries, federal bonds. They bought mortgage-backed bonds. And worldwide, central banks worldwide bought over $300 billion worth of this stuff on Friday, which has brought the market back up. And, you know, on the one hand, it's like, okay, that's a really good thing. They avoided the disaster. But on the other hand, we've got this structural mess as a consequence of, in 2002, the Bush administration saying, the banking regulators and the Bush administration say, we don't really need to regulate the banking industry anymore. Let the corporations do whatever they want. They can loan as much money as they want to anybody they want. And you ended up with these so-called ninja loans. No income, no job, but we'll give you a loan. You can write down anything you want in the loan application. Nobody's going to bother to check it. And this is like, I mean, this is metastasizing. This is like cancer. This is serious stuff. And they've postponed the meltdown for a couple of days here. And the question in my mind is, are they going to try and postpone the meltdown until the day after the elections in November of next year and then dump the whole thing in the Democrats' lap, just like they're trying to do with the war in Iraq? And my guess is yes. But we'll see. Len in Long Island, listening on WWRL. Hey, Len, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I spoke to you in the summer about the immigration issue, and I believe that if you look at last week, that murder by a illegal immigrant in Newark, New Jersey, was brought to light, and 2 days later, Bush is announcing a serious enforcement by the borders, and then you have Karl Rove leaving. I think they're all tied together. I think Karl Rove is a made man. He doesn't have to worry about making money now, but what he's doing is planning 2008. And they're going to run, instead of a Willie Horton, they're going to be running a Juan Ramirez campaign. And that's right. Going to be the focal point, that the Democrats are soft on immigration and border security.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't disagree with you.
That's going to be the centerpiece, because they've got nothing else at all.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right, Lennon. It's going to be interesting to see how it shakes up. Yeah, absolutely. So wake up. Brian in Redondo Beach, California. Hey, Brian.
Hey, what's going on, Tom? Good morning. All I can say is, ding dong, the witch is gone, the witch is gone.
Carl Rove. Hey, if you think he's gone, I got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you.
For a moment, he's gone. Now we got to get the man behind the curtain. That's the other thing in the Bush, the wonderful Bush of Oz of Bush. But, Tom, I want to also mention just this real quick. In September 29th, I really want to have this, like, on the air every single day, all day long, about the camp out that's going to be in front of Capitol Hill.
Right.
And just encourage the ones who can go. We need 1 million, 2 million, 3 million people to make a huge statement.
Yeah. Get to Washington, D.C. in September. Well said. Chales in Hill City, Indiana. About a minute before we've got to wrap up this hour, Chales.
Hey, glad you took my call. One of the things I'm wondering is what can we do other than get active in our Democratic Party to affect political change? Because as of so far, the last three major decisions, it's not working, Tom.
The trend line is in the right direction. We still have a lot of work to do with the Democratic Party, frankly, in my opinion. But I think that we need to be outspoken. We need to be writing letters to the editor. We need to be calling into talk shows. We need to be talking to our friends. We need to be, banging on the doors of members of Congress when they're in their home districts, talking to their home districts as well as to their federal numbers, calling all around. And also Democracy for America, Jim Dean's organization. They're doing some great trainings. You got a better idea, Chels?
No, that's why I'm asking you.
Okay, well, that's the thing. I'm saying, get involved in the political process. Go to democracyforamerica.com and sign up for one of their trainings. Al Franken, coming up next. Stick around.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. And with us today, Al Franken. Al Franken, welcome to your old program.
Well, it's your program now, Tom. I left.
I know, but
you've been doing this for a long, long time anyway. But you're in my slot, and I like that.
Well,
I like
too.
That.
I feel like I'm filling very large shoes. I'm very, very, very pleased to be here, and I'm very pleased to have you here. How's everything going in Minnesota?
Things are going great. The summer is the time to travel around the state because Minnesota is a big state, and the winter is not the time to travel around the state. So I've been doing a lot of touring of the 7th District, which is huge. The 7th District is bigger than a lot of states.
That's the way up north part, isn't it?
Well, it's actually the western to up north. I mean, it's a big area, and it's a lot of ag. And so I went to Farm Fest last week, and I think one of the first things I learned about ag policy, or at least about ag, is to wear a hat and drink lots of water, because I think I got mild heat stroke.
Mm.
But, agriculture is really important in Minnesota, but it's just important in this country in a number of ways. One, we eat food.
Yeah.
And two, there are tremendous energy possibilities in ag, in biofuels, but also in wind. And we have a very windy state here. And you learn little things like a farmer can't take a tax credit for putting up a wind turbine, but Florida Electric and Light can. And the reason is that the way the law is written is that you get a tax credit against passive income. In other words, investment income.
Right.
But you can't get a tax credit against earned income. It's
so the laws are written for to help people who earn their living by sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive and to screw people who work for a living or run an actual firm.
Yeah, so things like this are just drive me crazy. And because Minnesota is a windy state, especially southwestern Minnesota, and there's just a lot of things like that. And I actually was at Farm Fest with, there was kind of a forum, I'd say, with our members of the Ag Committee in Congress, including Colin Peterson, who's the chair of the Ag Committee. And but Norm Coleman was there, is the guy I'm going to be running against. And Mike Johans is there, and Tim Walz, who's the new congressman from the 1st District, and Amy Klobuchar, the new senator, both of whom are on the Ag Committee. And, you know, this bill passed unanimously through the Ag Committee and then got passed in the House.
This
and
the
part of the
bill.
Funding of it is a is to get rid of a loophole that has foreign corporations can create subsidiaries in the Bahamas. You've heard about this for a million years, and then funnel their income there and pay zero taxes on it. And this is a loophole that will yield, and the CBO has scored it, about $7.5 billion.
Yeah, this is what Halliburton did with Kellogg Brown and Root when they got all those contracts to take KBR over to Iraq. They said, cool, we'll reincorporate it in the Cayman Islands, and we'll take all these taxpayer dollars from the United States, from the taxpayers of the, dollar, of the United States, with guaranteed profits, and we won't pay a penny of income tax on it.
Oh, by the way, I mean, they did that for in Iran, too. And the reason they, part of the reason they did that is they created an offshore subsidiary because it was illegal to do work in Iran.
Right.
And so that's a whole other ball of wax. But,
right. But you're saying this is even infecting ag policy. There's company, big corporations that are involved in agriculture that are setting up offshore subsidiaries to shelter their profits?
This isn't necessarily about, I mean, this loophole isn't necessarily about ag corporations doing it. It's about any foreign corporation doing it.
I see.
And to close the loophole, which the Bush administration in 2002 wrote was an inappropriate loophole. Now, Secretary Johans, the Secretary of Agriculture, is there, and he says this is raising taxes.
And closing the loophole is raising taxes.
Yeah, he said that closing this loophole, now it's raising taxes, even though they had agreed that, you know, and what clearly it was the Republicans in Congress and the administration wanting to deny the Democratic Congress any achievements at all. That's mm-hmm. their strategy. So now something that was a loophole that they felt was an inappropriate loophole being closed. I mean, Colin Peterson, I talked to him the other night. I spent a lot of time with him. And he said, you know, he doesn't care really how we get the $7.5 billion for it. But he said, once he looked at this loophole, he said, I would have closed this whether it had anything to do with the ag bill or not.
Yeah,
it's just wrong. It's just it means that American corporations aren't on a level playing field. It's crazy. And
so they tried to close this loophole with the ag bill and failed. Is that the bottom line here?
No. They have. They've done it. It passed
the
House. Now it's going to the Senate. But the president was threatening to veto it.
Except what's happening is
that no one is dumb enough not to know that this is closing a loophole. So now they've changed their tune, and now what they're complaining about is funding for the McGovern Dole bill, which gives food to African kids to go to school. So
and that's a bad thing?
Oh, that's a terrible thing, because what it is, it's like it's the equivalent of giving food stamps to foreigners.
Yeah, you can't win hearts and minds. You've got to bomb them into liking you.
Yeah,
you can't feed them into liking you.
Well, not only that, but what it does is it gets them to go to school.
Yeah.
You know, kids get, if they get food at school, they'll go to school, and their parents will send them to school. So it is really in our interest. they have kids going, learning to read and going to school in Africa, so we don't have these failed countries that breed terrorists. And it's Bob Dole, for goodness sakes, who started this with George McGovern. So I was talking to Colin about this, Colin Peterson, and I said, you know who might be helpful in this? Liddy Dole.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to Liddy Dole. Cause I've actually,
and what's her position?
Her position has to be supportive of funding this because her husband came up with it. And also, I've heard her speak about it because I'm a member. I'm on the board of the Congressional Hunger Center, something started by a guy named Tony Hall from Dayton years ago. And I've been on the board of it for 10 years. And I've heard Liddy actually talk about this program very proudly. So this is they're going to go down another road that doesn't work.
Yeah,
and this is, you know, Tom Harkin is the chairman of the Ag Committee in the Senate, and he's going to take another bite at this apple on this bill, but it'll get passed, and it's basically a good bill.
Yeah,
it's,
I'm curious.
Achievement to get it out of committee and get it passed on time.
Indeed. We're talking with Al Franken, running for the United States Senate in Minnesota, formerly the guy at Air America who built this day part, this time slot, and who I competed with for a while, and now I'm following, and I'm very pleased to do so and to have on the program. I'm not sure we competed. We were just both out there, I guess would be the
best. We were on at the same time in certain different markets, but I didn't consider it competition. In fact, I think we were on each other's shows.
We were. Yeah, more than once.
You know, I mean, that's called that's friendly competition. The best
there you go.
Kind.
There you go. We're all on the same side. Al, we've got to take a break here in about 30 seconds, but I'm curious about your quick and initial take, and then if you think it's worth it, we can dig into it a little more after the break about Karl Rove's departure and what that's going to mean for the Bush administration, what it's going to mean for the Democrats, what it's going to mean for the upcoming election, and what it's going to mean for Karl Rove.
My initial take is that he must be quitting to spend more time with his family.
Yeah, he said that. said that.
You know, I'm running for the Senate to spend less time with my family.
Yeah, there you go.
But actually, I've been spending more time. I've been spending great time with Franny traveling around the state. But let's talk about that when we come back.
Yeah, okay, sounds like a plan. We're talking with Al Franken, formerly of Air America, now running for the United States Senate in Minnesota. AlFranken.com, is that the website, Al?
AlFranken.com, yes. That's
great.
Thanks, Tom.
Let us not forget. There you go. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you with Al Franken on the line on Air America Radio. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Hey, head over to 11thHourFilm.com. I'll be in Los Angeles on Friday of this week for the opening of Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour, which I'm in. It's going to be at the Landmark LA in West LA and the Arclight in Hollywood. I'll be in New York City on Monday of next week for the opening of The 11th Hour. It'll be at the Landmark Sunshine in East Village and in San Francisco Friday of next week. And you can get all the theater information. You can find the information over at our website, but also at 11thHourFilm.com. And, in fact, you can even get on a list to get information sent to you. We're talking with Al Franken, who's doing a very brave thing. This is and Al, I just, in the interest of disclosure, I had John Edwards on a little while ago, and I just think it's important to say this. I have contributed to his campaign. I have contributed to your campaign.
Well, thanks.
And people can do that. Well, you're a good guy, and the incredibly brave thing that you're doing is you're taking on a sitting U.S. senator, and that's damn hard to do. It's damn hard to do, and people
can
find out.
It's funny. People say this, and I don't want to discount. I take your that as a compliment that I'm brave to do this. But you know where I made this final decision to do it, because it was no secret that I was considering it for a while. I made it in Iraq, and I was on my fourth USO tour to Iraq last December. And I was doing kind of the gut check of, like, do I want to put myself through this? Do I want to put my family through this? Do I want to take crap from Republicans that I'm going to take? Do I want to, you know, be working, you know, 18 hours a day? And I looked around, and I saw these men and women who are on their third tour, some of them for 12 to 16 months away from their family, and having to worry about roadside bombs and getting shot at. And I said, you know what? I can do this. I can do this for 20 months. And so that's what I'm doing. And actually, it turns out to be a tremendous amount of fun. It's a great privilege. And we're getting amazing amount of support. Thank you for contributing. But we've had now over 42,000 donors. It's amazing.
That's
and from all over the country, this is going to be a national race. You can go to alfranken.com and help us.
That's
and
what
support
I do.
Us. And what's interesting is that I outraised Coleman, who is an incumbent. Last quarter, I raised $1.9 million. He raised $1.6 million. And he gets between a quarter and a third of his money from PACs. But not good PACs. He gets them from pharmaceuticals and insurance and from oil and coal. And that's what I'm up against. But I'm getting it from, actually, one of the things is he said he criticized me for getting so much money out of state. And then, the Minneapolis Star and Tribune did an analysis. And it turns out that I have more donors from inside Minnesota than he does. and he just confuses. This is something Republicans tend to do. They confuse money with people.
Mm.
You see, my average donation last quarter was $65.
Yeah.
You know, his was like 300 or something. And yeah. So much of it comes from, people are getting big tax breaks and from industries like the pharmaceuticals and the insurance companies that, because of Medicare Part D, the way it was written and the way he voted, Medicare can't negotiate with the pharmaceuticals, and that costs taxpayers tens of billions of dollars and costs seniors billions of dollars every year.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm fighting. So if your listeners can help out, alfranken.com.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about, you want to talk about Karl Rove?
Well, yeah, we're actually, you know, because we only have about 2 minutes left, and you know, that hard break at the bottom of the hour.
Hard break.
Infrastructure, I think, is a big issue, particularly in Minnesota, and I'm just curious your take on not necessarily specifically the bridge crash there in Minneapolis-St. Paul, but broadly the issue.
Well, it's all sort of an issue in investment. And it's not just investment in infrastructure, it's investment in education. It's about these Republicans have a number of, first of all, they run saying that government doesn't work.
Yeah, and they don't use that word investment. They use expenses.
And they prove it. But yeah. We think it can work. And part of the way it works is building infrastructure, which, by the way, creates jobs. And also, by the way, is good for Homeland Security. And also, there's other kinds of infrastructure in rural America. Again, what's good? They need broadband. They really do. Mm-hmm. We're behind other countries in broadband. It's crazy.
Right. Yeah, we're way behind, like South Korea, for example.
We're behind. We were ahead 10 years ago. We're way behind now, and we're behind on the speed. But it's really about investment in kids. An investment in early childhood education, the return on investment on that is astounding. It's great. And they would rather spend money on prisons.
Time, yeah, indeed. Time to start investing in America again. And one way to do it is to put a good senator, a good man in the Senate, alfranken.com. Al Franken, thanks so much for being with us.
Tom, thank you. You're doing a great job, man.
Thank you. You too. Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
Is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Karl Rove's only around for another few weeks, although George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, 525 days, 11 hours, 20 minutes, 3 seconds. Back in 1994, when George Bush Sr. had just conducted his war in Iraq, well, it was a little after the fact, and Dick Cheney was asked to pontificate about, you know, why didn't Bush Sr., good Republican, good war guy that he was, war president, why didn't he go to Baghdad? Why didn't he take out Saddam Hussein? And in 1994, this is 12 years ago right now, Dick Cheney said the following.
Do you think that the U.S. or U.N. forces should have moved into Baghdad?
No.
Why not?
Because if we'd gone to Baghdad, we would have been all alone. There wouldn't have been anybody else with us. It would have been a U.S. occupation of Iraq. None of the Arab forces that were willing to fight with us in Kuwait were willing to invade Iraq. Once you got to Iraq and took it over and took down Saddam Hussein's government, then what are you going to put in its place? That's a very volatile part of the world, and if you take down the central government in Iraq, you can easily end up seeing pieces of Iraq fly off. Part of it the Syrians would like to have to the west. Part of eastern Iraq the Iranians would like to claim, fought over for 8 years. In the north, you've got the Kurds, and if the Kurds spin loose and join with the Kurds in Turkey, then you threaten the territorial integrity of Turkey. It's a quagmire if you go that far and try to take over Iraq. The other thing was casualties. Everyone was impressed with the fact that we were able to do our job with as few casualties as we had. But for the 146 Americans killed in action and for their families, it wasn't a cheap war. And the question for the president in terms of whether or not we went on to Baghdad and took additional casualties in an effort to get Saddam Hussein was how many additional dead Americans is Saddam worth? And our judgment was not very many, and I think we got it right.
That was before he went back to work for Halliburton. And suddenly Iraq became very high priority. Pat Leahy, by the way, says, Karl Rove leaving? Yeah, okay, no problem. We're still going to look into this guy. Karl Rove saying, I'm not going to stay or leave based on whether it pleases the mob. Pat Leahy says he's not going to decide whether or not to investigate Karl Rove based on whether or not Karl Rove leaves or stays. The Judiciary Committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, going to continue their investigation into Karl Rove, who failed to comply with the Judiciary Committee's subpoena, by the way, about the firings, the mass firings of the U.S. attorneys. Apparently, Karl Rove was at the center of this thing. It's interesting to see this stuff play out. The public, by the way, this is a new public, survey by the Pew Research Center. Poll conducted by the Pew Research Center showed that more than half of Americans, and I'm telling you, this goes back to when Reagan in 87 did away with the Fairness Doctrine and that those provisions of the Fairness Doctrine that required radio stations to program in the public interest, and then Bill Clinton really, you know, put the bullet through the head in 1996 when he signed the Telecommunications Act. And basically said radio and television stations no longer have an obligation to the public to actually inform them. And then you had this federal court decision on behalf of Fox Television down in Florida back, what, about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, saying that they have the legal right to lie in their news. As the result of Steve Wilson and Jane Aker's lawsuit against Fox for trying to force them and then firing them, trying to force them to report false information about bovine growth hormone, and then firing them when they refused to report the false information. So as a consequence of this, a poll conducted by the Pew Research Center showed that more than half of Americans say U.S. news organizations are politically biased, inaccurate, and don't care about the people they report on. More than two-thirds, this is from editorandpublisher.com, more than two-thirds of the web users said they felt that news organizations don't care about the people they report on. 59% said their reporting was inaccurate, and 64% said that news organizations are politically biased. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, and Don in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Don, a lot on the table here today. It's summer. We're kind of all over the place. What's up?
Yeah, when I woke up this morning, I heard somebody commit a suicide for damaging America. And it was the Chinese. It was a Chinese guy. Sorry. I thought it was Rove.
Oh, yeah. Rove has already damaged America. In fact, when they were asking, they asked Joe Wilson what he thought, and he says, okay, this is, you know, playing out the, this is the end stage in the drama, the Valerie Plame outing a CIA officer. Actually, in fact, here's his exact quote. He said, this sordid tale of compromising national security to cover up and distract from the false rationale for the invasion of Iraq will forever remain in history a black mark on the Bush presidency. Well, hopefully it'll also be a conviction with a felony associated with it. We'll see how that shakes out. Liz in Valley Glen, California. Hey, Liz, what's on your mind today?
Hi. This is in relation to what you were speaking of earlier this morning about global warming. And mm-hmm. then when you had Al Franken on and he's talking about agriculture.
Yeah.
Well, last night I wake up in the middle of the night to this charming program about why civilizations declined. And they were speaking, they cited the Mesopotamia in the Middle East.
Yeah, the oldest story of a collapsing civilization is also the oldest known literature in Western civilization. It's the Epic of Gilgamesh from 7,000 years ago in the first city-state, Uruk, which is in Ur, which is now called northern Iraq. And they cut down the trees, the cedars of Lebanon and you know, much of that, and in order to plant barley. And then they diverted the Tigris and in order to irrigate it. And that diversion, first of all, cutting down the trees led to downwind desertification, and the diversion of the irrigation waters and the hyper-irrigation led to salination of the soil. The soil became so salty over time that it could no longer grow barley. And in the Epic of Gilgamesh, and this occurred over about a 300-year period, in the Epic of Gilgamesh, it is taught that this was the punishment of the gods for Gilgamesh going out and cutting off the head of Humbuba, the forest god, and that Enlil, the god of gods, decided to punish him for it, cutting off the forest god by cutting down the forest. And there's really an element of truth to it. It's a metaphorical way of saying that you cut down the forests and you hyper-irrigate the soil. You engage in these kinds of non-natural, non-renewable practices, and nature's going to bite you back.
And that's what the program stated. And they interviewed a farmer from the Central Valley here in California. And he says part of his land has already been salinated, and it's a real concern.
It is a major concern across the United States. Somewhere, depending on whose numbers you're quoting, and there's a chapter on this in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, somewhere between 20 and as much as 50% of the farmland in the United States is below 50% of its original productive capacity and at risk of being exhausted. You know, much of our soil now is exhausted in the United States. And the only way that we can grow is with artificial fertilizers that are made by and large from petroleum products. They're very expensive. The price is going up. And they only supply a small part of the spectrum of nutrients that you need, which is why organic foods, and this isn't just, you know, hey, some hippie telling you this. I mean, you know, there's good science on this. It's why organic foods are so much healthier. They have so many more nutrients. Elizabeth in West Bloomfield, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hi, Tom. I can't believe I'm on your show.
Well, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for being there. You're a great voice, and I was lucky to hear the interview you had with Al, and I too have supported Al, so he's
good,
getting it from all over the country, even from here in Michigan. The reason I called is, of course, the news about Karl Rove, and I just really need to understand from you or from one of your listeners, where does this executive privilege come from once he's gone from the office? I mean, it's kind of like me having, you know, the right to my computer after I leave my job. It just doesn't seem to make any sense. And I can understand if he had priest-penitent privilege or attorney-client privilege, but I think that privilege only extends as long as it's between you and another person. As soon as a third party or more people are involved in it, there isn't a privilege there. I just would really like to understand that more. Thanks so much for your show.
Okay, thank you, Elizabeth. First of all, with regard to the priest-penitent privilege, I mean, even that has been broached. If, for example, in many states have laws that say that if it involves abuse of a minor, for example, particularly sexual abuse, things like that, that it just doesn't apply anymore. But the doctrine of executive privilege is not in the Constitution. The doctrine of executive privilege, this is something that those activist judges came up with. And it's based on the concept that there should be a separation of powers, that the House and Senate, the legislative branch, has a particular set of powers and privileges. The executive branch has a set of powers and privileges, and the judicial branch has a set of privileges and powers. And the Supreme Court has ruled in a variety of rulings over the years that within the executive branch, on issues that have to do with national security or foreign policy, that the president should be able to get advice that is not exposed to the political winds of the House and Senate, or for that matter, the judiciary. But also, they very clearly ruled in the case of the U.S. versus Nixon, as I recall was the case, might have been a particular prosecutor versus Nixon, but anyhow, in the Nixon case during the Watergate era, that if the president is involved, or any of his advisors are involved in what may be criminal activity, there is no executive privilege. And so what Bush is doing is he's taking a very narrowly defined privilege that he has, which is designed to have to do with state security, national security, and foreign policy, and applying it right across the board to things like elections and prosecutors. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Well, it turns out, according to Jackson Thoreau, who is the Washington, D.C.-based journalist and writer, his most recent book, Born to Cheat, How Bush, Cheney, Rove, and Company Broke the Rules from the Sandlot to the White House, which is a brilliant book, by the way. The author of Born to Cheat, Jackson Thoreau, is arguing or pointing out or whatever in a new article that he has that you can find over at opednews.com or at the Daily Kos, and I'm sure it's all over the web now. I just got it from Jackson Thoreau an email. But in any case, he is arguing in this article that what happened, that the reason that Karl Rove is leaving is that when Dick Cheney hatched the scheme to trash Valerie Plame Wilson, that Karl Rove and Scooter Libby and Richard Armitage, and you know, that there was a bunch of them a part of it. This was a criminal enterprise to out a CIA officer that involved 5-6 people within the administration and went right to Dick Cheney's office. And Karl Rove, you will recall, went back before the grand jury 5 times. And Patrick Fitzgerald was about to indict him for lying to the grand jury, and he finally went back and said, I want to change my testimony, and he came clean. And there was apparently a debate within the grand jury about whether, okay, he's lied to us a couple of times, now he's telling the truth, does that mean we can't indict him? And the conclusion, apparently, that Patrick Fitzgerald came to was that they couldn't indict Rove. But they did indict Scooter Libby, obviously was told, don't worry, Scooter, you're a made man. You got nothing to worry about. We'll take care of you. But Rove was referred to as Official A. Remember that in the indictment? So anyhow, the bottom line here is that ever since Libby got nailed, that Cheney is the way Dick Cheney pronounces it. He likes the fact that everybody else mispronounces his own name. Anyhow, Cheney has been so PO'd at Karl Rove all this time for not taking the fall, instead for Scooter Libby taking the fall, that he's the guy who finally got Rove pushed out of office. Interesting. Ellen Ratner on the line with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, good morning, Ellen.
Good morning.
Good afternoon, I guess it is out there.
Yeah, pushed out, maybe. I would say 50% of me goes with that theory. The other 50% of me goes with the cash out theory, which is that he really believes he can make a lot of money writing a book right now while Bush is still in office, and even though it might not come out till after, and two, working on some of these new presidentials.
Yeah, I've been suggesting that he's going to go down the Kissinger road. He's going to create a consulting company, bring in a few people to give him some arm's length from other people that probably won't even have his name on the door, unlike Kissinger and Associates, and, time to become a millionaire.
Exactly. Or a multimillionaire. It would be more like it.
Yeah, exactly.
He's probably already got enough irons in the millionaire pot that he doesn't need to just make a million, but he wants to make a lot of money. And that is my guess. He'll get a huge advance for the book, and he'll also start to work with some other people.
Yeah, well, Scooter got $5 million just by putting up a website and saying, send me some money.
Well, he also had some really big people. Carville's wife, Mary was working for
Mary
him.
Matlin,
So
Fred Thompson pushing for him.
Right. I mean, he had some big guys in there. And, of course, the vice president.
What do you think about this story that came out today that Harry Reid and George Bush cut a deal that Bush would not push through any recess appointments if Harry Reid would actually recess the Senate? And what do you think about my theory that the part that Bush had to deliver to Reid in exchange for the part that Reid had to deliver to Bush in exchange for that was to give him the FISA bill?
Well, I think the FISA bill was a deal like no other deal has ever been cut. And so there's no question that a deal was made with the Democrats on that. Now,
right. So could the deal have been no recess appointments?
That we'll find out, but that may have been part of the deal. If you do not see a recess appointment, given Bush's past pattern of recess appointments, then you know that deal was completely cut. So we've got, another 2 weeks or so to figure that one out. But my guess is if you do not see any recess appointments of any major sort, maybe there's a recess appointment of something minor, but we're talking major recess, judicial, or other appointments, then you know that deal was cut like no political deal has ever been cut. So, yes. The deal is yes.
Yeah, that's rather depressing. I mean, we were all excited back, a month or so ago when Harry Reid was saying that he was going to call the Senate into session every Friday for 1 hour so that Bush couldn't do recess appointments. This is sort of like the 30 pieces of silver kind of thing. We'll see.
Also, Bush, don't forget, wants his little Republicans out in the field doing both pushing Bush's agenda and also pushing anything else going on. So that's right.
The Republicans wanted the vacation, too.
Exactly. Everybody wants a vacation, please. People are people. The other thing I just wanted to mention a little bit was the Iowa straw poll, which I think is ridiculous. But I think that what is not so ridiculous is where we're seeing Huckabee in it. Nobody thought Huckabee was, anything but a blip on the radar screen. And so do I think Huckabee's going to be the nominee? No. But Huckabee does bring a state with him, albeit not a lot of electoral votes. And he's in the South, and so
he's a very good public speaker. He's a former preacher.
Right. He's a former Baptist minister. I had a little conversation with him because he put a woman to death who had killed her two children, the first Arkansas woman executed in I don't know how long, maybe ever. And so Huckabee's on this health kick now and is talking to everybody about sort of holistic kinds of health issues. And so he is speaking to people where they live on some of those issues.
Yeah, he's the guy who lost 100 pounds, isn't he?
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly.
And so his... Go ahead.
He's had a lot of advertisements, and and he's really promoted prevention health care, which he should be really supported for.
Which is
Arkansas.
A fine thing, except that he's saying, let's all, you know, it's your responsibility to stay healthy rather than it's government's responsibility to make sure that everybody has health care.
Well, that's really, for sure.
They're really different things.
That's for sure, but people hear him and they hear health.
Yeah. Ellen Radner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program. On Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Welcome back to the third hour of our Monday program here. Are we all becoming rats in the U.S. military's psychological operations maze? Heather Vokush has some unique insights into this. She's an independent journalist and author of The Progressive's Handbook, reporting and living and writing out of Austria, that country there in Europe. And her website, Heather Vokush, which is spelled WOKUSCH.com. Heather, one of my favorite writers. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back on. It's great talking to you.
Great to have you here. Are we all becoming rats in the U.S. military's maze?
Well, you know what I found interesting, Tom, and that's why I wrote the article. I don't know if you remember back in 2003, the Pentagon, it came out that the Pentagon had this document, the Information Operations Roadmap, and it really became a big stink that they talked about using PSYOP or psychological operations. What I found interesting is this latest thing that came out of Purdue University. They blatantly spoke about, you know, using, you know, testing psychological operations, and no one was interested. I mean, the media didn't report it. It was just a big yawn. And so I found it interesting that in 4 years, the level of awareness even or caring about whether or not this could be used on the U.S. public is just, it's just not there. And I think that's of concern.
Yeah, the article that you're referring to that you wrote is titled Welcome to the Jungle, U.S. Military Psychological Operations and You. And give us a thumbnail sketch of what they're up to here, Heather.
Well, as I mentioned before, they had this Information Operations Roadmap. This was a 2003 Pentagon document. Later, in 2006, it was declassified. And in that document, Rumsfeld personally approved. What they had said was that, you know, you're not legally allowed to test propaganda intended for foreign audiences on the U.S. citizens.
This is the Smith Act, isn't it?
That's exactly correct, you know. But this Pentagon document said, well, you know what, with the distinction between foreign and domestic audiences because of global news, we really can't make that distinction anymore. So that's kind of one of the things that set this up. Now, the most recent thing is there's, as I mentioned, this wild thing that came out of Purdue University, and it's called the Sentient World Simulation. And what they're trying to do, it's almost like a little matrix. They want to match one person on Earth to a kind of cyber, you know, person in this, you know, imaginary world, along with infrastructure and groups and institutions and everything. And once they have a kind of copy in the cyber world, then they want to test things on it. Well, the interesting thing is, who is actively involved in this? Well, the Department.
Well, hang on. If I may just interrupt you before
yeah.
just so that our listeners really understand what you're saying. It's as if they were to come to New York City, for example. Well, it's a pretty big city, but they might do it with a smaller one like Portland, Oregon, where I live. If they came to Portland, Oregon, and they built a database dossier on all of the roughly million people who live here, and the metro area is a little smaller than a million, with what they do for a living, whether they're married, how old they are, how much they weigh, their broad psychological profile, how they spend their money on their credit cards, what their medical history is, and then they create an alternative world, one of these sim worlds, a simulated world on a computer, and it looks like Portland, the simulated world, and they create these little people in this world, and each one of them becomes one of us. And so there's a Randy White there, and there's a David Poole there, and there's a me there, and with complete with the psychological profile, a physical profile, going to work, and throughout the course of the day, all these people are moving around Portland, and they're going to work, and they're going to the restaurants, and they already know from credit card records which restaurants people are going to and how much they're using. And they've got all this, and they've got the city running. It's actually running. And they say, okay, now let's see what happens if we drop a nuclear bomb into this square block, or if we set off a dirty bomb over here, or if we blow up this building here, that kind of thing. Or what happens if we decide, if it looks like there's a terrorist attack and this apartment building is taken hostage, that kind of thing. How do people react? Or what happens if we put up surveillance cameras all around the city and we do it instantly? How do people react versus how do people react if we do it one every week slowly? Do I have is that a relatively accurate picture of what they're doing?
Yes, I would say so. I would absolutely say so. Now, I should say that this technology has been used, for example, with the corporate world to try to,
sure,
let bosses react with synthetic people. But what they're doing it now is, the picture that you described. And one thing that's really interesting is there is one organization that has achieved a one-to-one level of, for this simulation. And you know what that is? That's the U.S. Army. Because they're using this technology to identify potential recruits. So we could throw into your thing, what if in this, city of Portland, if they say, okay, we're going to bring back the draft, what happens then? How do people react? Because
right,
the whole point is if you know how people can react, then in advance you can figure out how better to, get them to do what you want to do, essentially. And the reason that this whole idea of psychological operations is being connected to the system that we're discussing, the sentient world simulation, is because in the concept paper for it, they just blatantly stated this provides an environment to test psychological operations. And yet nobody's talking about it. So I find that to be really fascinating. And the fact that the Defense Department and Homeland Security is all over the system is something of a worry as well.
And when I interrupted you before to do that kind of expanded explanation of what it was, you were about to say, and it's interesting who's involved with this.
Well, again, you've got, again, the Department of Homeland Security. You've got DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Anything that is involved in the U.S. military is very interested in this, and they have funded it to the tune of millions of dollars. Now, the question, again, is if, for example, we'll go back to your example, if, Portland is one of the examples, well, if they're testing the effects of psychological operations on Portland, that goes against the law, but we will never know about it. That's the fear.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. I mean, this is something that Goebbels could have only dreamed of.
Right, but I didn't write this article mainly for a bummer. I just think we just have to be even more vigilant. And how ironic that right now we've got this Pat Tillman case going on. And I mean, just today I read that the 3-star general in charge wants to actually defend himself in a court. This is a classic case of misinformation and psyop. And so I think if we just can get more aware of identifying this stuff as it happens, then we can fight back.
Right. We're talking with Heather Vokush. Her website, heathervokush.com, spelled WOKUSCH.com. And Heather, another piece that you wrote recently that I thought was particularly brilliant, Under the Radar, 10 Warning Signs for Today.
Yeah. What I found was interesting about them, thank you for your kind words, it was 10 things that were kind of making me nervous. And now, this is only 2 weeks later, two of them have already come true. So one of them was a media mogul, Murdoch, wanted to buy Dow Jones. Okay, well, this went through. And also, another point was this market meltdown. Well, I mean, we saw last Thursday and Friday. Not only did the Fed have to pump, over $80 billion just to stabilize the markets, but one thing that we maybe don't, realize is if anything happens to the U.S. markets, man, they just crash internationally. And so the European Central Bank had to pump $214 billion, into the banking system on Thursday and Friday just to keep the markets afloat.
Yeah, the worldwide total was over $300 billion.
Yeah, and you know, they can't do that very often. And so the question
I'm wondering if they're going to just continue doing that until the day after the elections in November.
Well, that's a good point, but I guess the question is also how many other, you know, how often can, for example, Europe do that? How often, how many bonds can you sell? And you know, who does this really hurt? This hurts developing countries also. So that's something that we need to watch, especially because it looks as if this whole, you know, hedge fund disaster and the subprime, you know, disaster, it's not going to get any better, you know, anytime soon.
Well, there's a couple of trillion dollars worth of bad U.S. mortgage paper out there. Are they just going to mop it up by inflating currencies and buying them through central banks?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. But the question also is, what are central banks in other countries going to do? Because I can tell you, boy, was there a lot of anger over here, you know, last week, Thursday and Friday.
Oh, really?
Pieces very angry at the United States for their economic, you know, the irresponsibility. And so that's a really loose, open question about how long can they actually keep this up. If this can last until the elections, that'll be quite something.
Yeah, and this goes back to 2002, 2003, when the Bush administration basically stopped regulating banks, and boom, all hell is breaking loose now as a result of it. Deregulation, ain't it wonderful? Heather Vokush, W-O-K-U-S-C-H. There's also a link from AirAmerica.com from our blog over there. Heather, thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Talk to you soon. Bye.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Just last year, a Cincinnati-based provider of video surveillance equipment inserted glass-encapsulated microchips into the arms of two employees, writes John Diaz in this weekend's Sunday Oregonian. Those two workers volunteered, but he says, but it's not hard to imagine the light bulbs going off in corporate America. These RFID chips, these are passive chips that when they scan you, you know, it's like it's like when you go up the checkout counter at the supermarket. They scan the barcode and bing, it knows, you know, what that item is and what the price is. They scan you from a distance and they know everything that's on the chip. Okay. So you see light bulbs going off in corporate America. Is Joe really making a sales call, or is he taking in a baseball game at AT&T Park? How many smoke breaks is Mary taking? Amazingly, he notes, California has no law against chipping workers, inserting microchips in them as a condition of employment. Joe Simitian, I believe it's how it's pronounced, the Democrat from Palo Alto, has put forward legislation giving people the right to say no and not lose their jobs, and he was quite surprised by how much resistance he got. It cleared the state Senate in California by a 25-11 vote. Now, John notes in this article, such chips have become the ticket to access in VIP lounges in certain trendy clubs from Barcelona, Spain to Miami Beach. A patron can even buy a round of drinks without even having to roll up his sleeve, let alone reach for his wallet. You just wave your arm and the waiter or waitress is standing there with a scanner. You wave your arm within a few feet of it and boom, it goes bing-ing, you know, and it's got your information. Now, this seems kind of like the nice side of it, isn't it? Kind of cool. Gee, I can get a chip in my arm and I don't, you know, and I go shopping and I don't have to pull my credit card out. Well, then we have yesterday's New York Times. Keith Bradshaw writing for the New York Times. At least 20,000 police surveillance cameras are being installed along streets in Shenzhen, China. This is a city I visited back in the 1980s, back when it was a little sleepy backwater. It's now a major industrial center with over 12 million people. When I was there, there was probably fewer than a million people. And it will be guided by sophisticated computer software from an American-financed company to recognize automatically the faces of police suspects and detect unusual activity. And they're also going to give everybody in the city, 12.4 million people, a chip. Now, this is a chip. They're not going to put it under their skin yet. This is a chip that will be in their ID card, on their essentially the Chinese equivalent of a driver's license. Data on the chip will include, I'm reading this from Keith Bradshaw's piece in the New York Times, data on the chip will include not just the citizen's name and address, but also work history, educational background, religion, ethnicity, police record, medical insurance status, and landlord's phone number. Even personal reproductive history will be included for enforcement of China's controversial one-child policy. Oh, he already has a child. And where are they going? Is that a bedroom? You can't do that. Plans are being studied to add credit histories, subway travel payments, and small purchases charged. The Chinese government has ordered all large cities to apply such technology to police work. The company that's doing this is called China Public Security, and it's a Florida corporation. They raised their money from two investment funds, one in Plano, Texas, the Pinnacle Fund. Excuse me, both of them in Plano, Texas, the Pinnacle Fund and the Pinnacle China Fund. And three investment banks have put together the money for this: Roth Capital Partners in Newport Beach, California, Oppenheimer & Company in New York, and First Asia Finance Group of Hong Kong. Shenzhen, a computer manufacturing center next to Hong Kong, is the first Chinese city to introduce the new residency cards. It is also taking the lead in China in the large-scale use of law enforcement surveillance cameras, a tactic that would have drawn international criticism in the year after the Tiananmen Square killings in 1989, but rising fears of terrorism have lessened public hostility to surveillance cameras in the West. Shenzhen already has 180,000 of these cameras all around the city right now. Every police officer in Shenzhen now carries global positioning satellite equipment on his or her belt. It allows senior police officers to direct their movements on large, high-resolution maps of the city that China Public Security has produced. This is the Florida Corporation, using software that runs on the Microsoft Windows operating system. Robin Huang, the chief operating officer of China Public Security, says, "We have a very good relationship with U.S. companies like IBM, Cisco, HP, and Dell. All of these U.S. companies work with us to help us build our system together." All Chinese citizens are required to carry national identity cards with very simple computer chips embedded. Since imperial times, a principal technique of social control has been for local government agencies to keep detailed records on every resident. And in the meantime, Robert Mugabe, the dictator of Zimbabwe, has passed a law saying that he can open anybody's mail, listen to anybody's phone call. Why, he says? Because you have such a law in the United States. If Bush can do it, so can I.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
I don't want millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Won't you give me back my job again?
34 minutes past the hour.
I don't.
Hey, reminder, this Friday I'll be doing this show from our Los Angeles affiliate, K-Talk, in L.A., and that evening there will be a screening, or it's the opening, actually, of Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour, which you will find my smiling face in, along with about 50 other people. And then on Monday of next week, I'll be in New York for the same, and then Friday of next week, I'll be in San Francisco for the same. In New York, we'll be broadcasting from WWRL in San Francisco from the Quake. and doing our program and then showing up for the openings. So it should be great fun. For more information, you can go to 11thhourfilm.com, 11thhourfilm.com. And, of course, at the top of TomHartmann.com, there is the trailer for the thing and a link both to the 11th Hour Film site and also to the 11th Hour Action site if you want to participate in things. A little bit of good news. First of all, tip of the hat to the folks in the chat room for one of these. UN nuclear inspectors reach understanding with North Korea. And let's see, this, thank you, Klan, for this. And UN inspectors on Friday said they reached a mutual understanding with North Korea after visiting a nuclear reactor in the center of efforts to disarm the communist country. So that's a good thing, right? Mutual understanding, calming down tensions. And here's another one. Last week we were reporting how China had threatened the United States with the nuclear option, what they referred to as the nuclear option, of dumping the dollars to crash the world, you know, to crash the United States. Well, apparently they looked at the world markets on Thursday and Friday and said, whoa, we don't want to do this. This will hurt us too. Beijing, this is from today's Financial Times by Richard McGregor in Beijing. Beijing yesterday sought to repair fallout from reports that it could use its 1.330 trillion in foreign exchange holdings to put pressure on Washington and the dollar, with a statement affirming the importance of the U.S. dollar as a global reserve currency. The statement followed an article last week by the London-based Daily Telegraph asserting Beijing had launched a concerted campaign of economic threats against Washington with hints it could liquidate U.S. dollar holdings. But now they say China is going to be, quote, a responsible investor in the international capital markets. U.S. dollar assets, including U.S. government, American government bonds, are an important component of China's foreign exchange reserves as the dollar enjoys a major position in the international monetary system, et cetera. So, you know, I guess that's good news for the moment. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Brian in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Appreciate what you do. I'm listening to you on AM 760 KKCN in Denver.
A fine station.
It is. You mentioned Roe wanting to make millions. The Farm Bill is being hailed for having a ceiling on income for the recipients. And to my knowledge, only Jim Hightower is reporting that ceiling on income is $1 million yearly and $2 million for couples. My question is, how can we get our Congress people to be more relevant to the middle class?
Yeah, well, and the answer, I'd say, Brian, is that we, the middle class, or those of us who would, in particular, those people who are arguably the working poor and not yet the middle class, need to get involved in the political process. It's just there's just no other way to do it. We have to be in their faces all the time. And even more important, we have to be part of the system that's making them work. Ralph, also listening to us on KKZN, that's AM 760 in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph.
Yeah, Tom, earlier you talked about the guns that the Italians apparently have been provided to the Iraqis.
Well, they busted up the deal before it happened. It was the mob, the Italian mafia, was actually collaborating with the Iraqi government, which raises the question, does the American government have the right to stop the deal to sell 100,000 AK-47s into Iraq?
Well, my question then is basically this. There are 190,000 weapons, apparently, that the U.S. Army can't account for in Iraq.
Right.
We know where the friendly weapons went. They went to friendlies, but there are 190 unaccounted for.
190,000, yeah.
Yeah, well, doesn't that mean that the United States Army is supplying the terrorists with weapons? And if so, doesn't that make them, how shall I say, terrorists under the USA Patriot Act? So shouldn't the CIA be sending its rendition teams over to the Pentagon and taking away a few generals?
Yeah.
I mean, after all, the generals that are...
No, your logic is impeccable. Your logic is impeccable. Unfortunately, it's logical, and that's not something that lies in the Bush administration. But, Ralph, yeah, indeed. There you go. Good one. Thank you very much, Ralph. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, listening on KGOE. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Yeah, so you might, I don't know if you know that that Iowa straw poll, Saturday night, there was an hour and a half delay, and, I was talking to Aaron Russo's, press secretary last week, and she was warning me that they might, screw over, Ron Paul, and that straw poll last week. So, you know, I'm having a little problem believing the results of that. And we can look forward to more of this.
Wouldn't that be interesting if they decided that Huckabee was the least offensive of all of them, and they simply flipped his votes with Ron Paul's votes?
Well, yeah, and then Sam Brownback, remember they were talking about the possibility, Sam Brownback, the fundamentalist nut, they were talking about the possibility he might get out of the race if he, you know, if he didn't do so good. Now he's going to stay in the race. So, the religious right still controls the Republican Party, so nobody needs to worry about it.
Yeah, and the voting machines still control the political process. Amazing, Joe. Thanks a lot for the comment. Ron in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind today?
Good Monday, everyone. This Cheney scenario you were mentioning earlier, he was the Secretary of Defense under Bush 1. He's the guy that privatized a lot of the military functions that allows Halliburton to charge $27 for a plate of food, and if a soldier picks up an empty plate to put on top, well, that's another $27.
Well, in fact, it was Cheney as Defense Secretary who ordered a study to be done about how to privatize the military, and the study was done by Halliburton.
Then
when he left the government, he went to work for Halliburton and implemented the recommendations of Halliburton about how Halliburton could privatize the military.
And his wealth from the Secretary of Defense being $1 million went to a total of $65 million within 5 years.
Yeah.
So that's clear evidence of something. But I really wanted to mention
It's clear evidence of the Republican way, Ron.
Right. I wanted to mention something else about the environmental situation. 9 states have legalized the production of hemp. Canada's legalized it. And hemp sequesters 4 times the oxygen, the carbon dioxide that forests do because it grows 10 feet in 10 weeks and there's virtually no THC in industrial hemp, but yet it'll produce everything petrochemicals will, while hardly no pollution involved in the processing of it. So, you know, there's a whole same thing with spirulina, 70% protein, 90% digestible, the same amino acid ratio as human flesh. We could be making changes. People talk about all these antioxidants like vitamin C and things that they need. There are things 20 times more potent as an antioxidant than vitamin C. So people need to realize that we're on the threshold of a whole new paradigm. They need to open their minds a little bit and start saying, hey, we can make it, but we're going to have to change the way we do things a bit. And we don't need these Luciferian types at the top, these corporatists that are calling all the shots. We need to have a valid electoral process so people have a choice.
Right. No, very, very well said, Ron. And in fact, two of the points that are made in Leo DiCaprio's new movie, one is that the problem that we're facing is a problem of political will. And they have a shot of the White House and of Bush and Cheney right there. And the other is that with existing technology, I think this is in the trailer. You can see it up at over at 11thhourfilm.com or at the top of TomHartmann.com. With existing technology, we can reduce the human carbon footprint on this planet by 90%. And that's without inventing anything. And I guarantee you, there's more inventions to come. So, interesting. 1-866-303-2270, Virginia in Seattle. Hey, Virginia, welcome to the program.
Hi. We recently had a problem here with the landlord. I mean, it's been ongoing for the last 4 or 5 months. He won't repair the ceiling in the bathroom, yet he thinks he has the right to go to City Light and find out how much my electric bill is, which, of course, has gone up.
Wait a minute. You've got a landlord who is snooping on, who is going to your electric supplier and asking to see copies of your electric bill?
Yes, and this apparently is one of our RCW things recently introduced that they can do this. Now, I understood that the right to privacy was constitutional right. And
yeah, it's the Fourth Amendment. You know, you shall be secure in your home, in your personal, in your papers and personal effects.
And I also understand that state law does not supersede the Constitution.
That's true, but there's been so much recently that has superseded the Constitution that it's getting spooky. I mean, the Patriot Act, in my opinion, is strongly unconstitutional. You've got, you know, obviously the Military Commissions Act, the John Warrior Defense Act. Virginia, I'm sorry to hear about your landlord. I hope that you can find some legal remedy. The Fourth Amendment very, very quickly says explicitly, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures, And it doesn't even say by the government. It simply says against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And no warrants shall be issued but except upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. You think there's no ambiguity there that I can tell. It's very, very straightforward. We have the right to privacy. It's laid out there. Well, unless you're a Bushy, I am really increasingly, I guess, you know, the most positive interpretation is that these guys just don't read the Constitution. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
9.5 minutes before the hour.
And the people in the houses all go to the university and they all get put in boxes, little boxes, all the same.
Actually, a lot of them go out and work on construction and sites. Terry O'Sullivan is with us. He is the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA.org, their website. Hey, Terry.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm fine. I hope you're well today. Labor news. What's on your radar?
Well, what's on our radar is immigration. Mm-hmm. There was a Department of Homeland Security issued a new regulation on Friday that's going to affect some 140,000 employers and over 5,000 workers. What they've done is any employers that get no match Social Security letters. Are now instructed to displace those, fire those workers where they have after a 90-day period where they have no match Social Security numbers.
Yeah. I lived in Germany for a year, and in order to get permission to live there for a year, I had to go through about 3 months of going back and forth with the government and proving that I actually had a job there, and my employer had to prove that they couldn't find a German who could do that job. Because my job was being the English-speaking negotiator for a nonprofit that was, also had an American branch, and if I had been caught in Germany taking a paycheck and using their national healthcare system without the permission of the government, without the equivalent of a green card, I would have gone to jail.
Yeah.
And that the same is true of Mexico, by the way. Mexico, I have some friends who are living down in Mexico, and actually we have some friends living in Panama. The same is true in Panama. If you're caught in any of those countries working and you haven't gone through the proper channels to either get permission to work or become a citizen, they nail your butt to the wall.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that?
Well, Tom, look at that. Here's the way LIUNA looks at it and the way I do is that we have a broken immigration system and we're for border increased border security. We're for employee verification systems. We're for no match Social Security numbers, but it should all be done in the context of talking about comprehensive immigration reform. We have 12 million people 12 million or more undocumented immigrants supposedly in this country. If they all left tomorrow, I know the construction industry would be at a complete and total standstill. So while we're for the things that you just talked about, it should be done in the context of talking about comprehensive immigration reform. What is it that we're going to do with the 12 million undocumented immigrants that are living and working in this country now? I think needs to be part of the discussion about immigration reform and not border security.
Well, let me respectfully, there are more than 12 million people in the United States who are either unemployed or are earning less than $9,000 a year. And If those 12 million workers who are here in the United States left tomorrow, then we would not have a massive poverty problem in the United States. I mean, as long as we've got ghettos in the United States, it's impossible to say that we have too many or we have too few workers in this country. If what would happen is that the buildings trades industry, for example, just to use that as an example, would suddenly have to start paying more. And when they started paying more, you would have people saying, okay, I will work for that. You know, I can raise a family for that. And I mean, I remember when I was going to college, when I was in my 20s, early 20s, the guy who had the apartment next to me worked construction, and he was raising a family working construction. I mean, he was making more money than a lot of people I knew. He was doing very, very well. And it just isn't so much the case anymore. And I think that if you were to reduce the labor force, I mean, this is what labor has been arguing for ever since the 1880s, when the railroads started busting unions by bringing in Chinese labor. If you were to reduce the labor force available, you drive up the price of labor and you drive up the wages.
Now, I wish in the construction industry, I wish it would work that way. I mean, what we're facing right now, Tom, is a worker shortage. We're having trouble in many parts of this country of manning the projects that we have right now. And so what we think is that employers are the ones that depress wages, not immigrant workers. I mean, when an employer uses their status against them, they can depress the wages. There's no argument about that. But there needs to be an orderly transition, and comprehensive immigration reform, we believe, is the way to do that. Again, supporting all of the principles that you talked about before. But doing it in such a way that is respectful of the contribution that immigrant workers have made to our country, to our community, and to our economy. And at the same time, whether it's fines, whether it's, you know, have to learn English, we're supportive of all those things, but we need to do it in a way that doesn't disrupt the economy of this country and doesn't disrupt the industries in which immigrant workers now work in.
Yeah, I would agree that our immigration system is broken there. And my sister-in-law, for example, is an immigrant, and she's in the middle of getting her U.S. citizenship. She's been working on it for 5 years.
Yep.
I'm familiar with the system, and I had to go down and testify. In fact, yes, she's actually married to my brother-in-law, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, it's really serious stuff. There's 2 million Iraqi refugees who would love to come here. There are refugees all over the world who would love to come here. Why should we give first place to people who came here illegally?
Well, I think what we need to do is that when you talk about comprehensive immigration reform and a path to earn legalization, you don't wave a wand and legalize them the next day. It's about an 11-year process. There's fines associated with it. And think that should be part of this discussion in that debate. It's extremely controversial, but it's something we need to get our hands around.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. Terry O'Sullivan, LIUNA.org, the Laborers International Union of North America. Terry, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks again, Tom.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past, well, wrapping up the hour. Coming up tomorrow, Devin Herrick and I will be debating the state children's health insurance program. Max Blumenthal from The Nation is going to be here on Pentagon sending evangelical crusaders to Iraq. And Dr. Mark Meany prepared to go further than sicko on health care issues, plus your calls and the best of the rest of the news. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.